Hi, quickly before we jump into the episode, me and Tim wanted to take a second to highlight an unfortunate thing that happened to a friend of the show, Melissa Mazaros. Sorry if I screwed that up, Melissa, who runs Don't Hide PR, a company that does PR for a lot of comic creators and who obviously has helped facilitate a lot of interviews for us. And in general, is just a nice and beyond helpful person in comics. She and her husband lost their home in the holiday farm fires a few weeks ago. We can't begin to imagine how hard and devastating it would be to lose your home belongings and just like a general sanity and peace of mind. Luckily, they and their animals are okay, but their home was lost in the fire. There's a current GoFundMe going for Melissa, which we'll link in the notes, but if you go to GoFundMe and search for Help Melissa and Ren Rebuild, you will find it. Comics can be a great community, so anything that helps out someone like Melissa, who helps others and has a great passion for comics, and again, is just generally one of the nicest people, would be awesome. Thanks for your time, and now for this episode of Pages and Panels. All right. Welcome to this episode of Secret and Lies, your only podcast for detailed breakdowns of the George Lopez Show, episode by episode. I am one of your hosts, Kyle Overkill, joined by my co-host, Tim. How you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. Living the dream in California right now.
Yeah. The fire still going? No.
They're under control.
I know you're farther away, so it's less.
Yeah, they weren't any. Where they were like 200 miles away from me, so
all I have to worry about is raking my yard, which is an inconvenience at most. But Tim, we did it again. I don't even know why we try.
It's like the 100th time in a row.
I know. I'm sorry. I keep doing it to you. We're not gonna be able to talk about the episode of the George Lopez Show when Benny learns that George's father, who left her years ago to care for George alone, is now wealthy. And she decides she deserves to get rich herself. And after she's drunk at work, she falls down on work premises and pretends to get hurt to get workman's comp. But then she finds out she is only going to get $375, so she plans to sue them for $1 million. We actually have a really good episode. We're going to be talking to artist, creator Chris Sheehan about one of the books I was most excited about coming into September and the fall season, The Autumnal. I was 100% sure I was going to screw that up, but I'm really excited. Thanks for joining us, Chris.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I was like, Autumnal seems like a word I'm going to screw up numerous times, but...
No, I had to look it up. I was saying it wrong for a long time.
Oh, really? I don't even know if I'm saying it right. I'm just guessing.
Yeah, that's right.
So, we're recording this, I guess you would call it the eve of the release. If you're listening to this, it'll be out that week. So it is in stores. Definitely go pick it up. It's one of my favorite things I've read this summer, fall, going into it. But for you, I'm always interested in how that feels, especially like now we kind of see the reviews start to hit like, you know, Monday and Tuesday, and then going into it, and I saw like some stores are selling out, and it's kind of building to go into tomorrow. Like, how is that as a creator, kind of everything you've worked on for a lot of times, you know, you're working on these for a year, months ahead of time, and how does it feel going into a release tomorrow?
I'm pretty excited. This is my first time doing a book with a publisher that's not like self-published and distributed, like paid for by Kickstarter and stuff. This is the first time I've done something that'll actually show up in comic shops, and other than like covers that I've done in the past, and I'm really excited. I was worried that because I am a nobody and no one knows who I am, that it wouldn't do well, and then I heard that it sold out, and I'm excited and a little nervous. I hope people like it.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's the second they showed. I mean, I've seen obviously your cover work, Deadbeat, and then I'm blanking on it. What was I'm gonna blank on the name. You did, I think it was like four issues.
Yeah, I Prometheus. And issue 5 will be done sometime this year. I'm trying to fit it in. That'll be the finale. But yeah, I did a little mini series called Prometheus with Ryan Little, which was funded on Kickstarter, and then Deadbeat, which we just kind of print it ourselves and sell it, and Jed, the writer, also sells it digitally.
I saw you were doing it. I was excited. I mean, your covers are great. I know you did the one for She Said Destroy. We had them on when that came out. And I guess I think just the second you see those preview pages, they're beautiful. But obviously being kind of attached with Daniel, how did that come about, you guys kind of teaming up with that on this book?
So I actually had the editor at Vault, Adrian, reach out to me. They had already been in talks with Daniel, and it kind of lined up really well, being everything that I wanted to work on next. Like, I was it was really weird. Because I didn't tell anyone. Other than my girlfriend, I wanted my next book to be kind of like a little more, like grounded in like reality and earth, because I was working on a sci-fi thing at the time, and I wanted to do something horror, something like spooky, and I was a fan of Daniel's, but I had no clue he was going to be doing comics. And I had Adrian reach out to me and to kind of explain to me the plot of the book, just to kind of see if I was interested. And I was. It was everything that I wanted to do. And then he told me that it was Daniel Krauss. And I was like, whoa, that's really cool. So I didn't want to say no, because I've also, like, it's been a goal to do something bigger with Vault other than covers. And so this kind of just, it all kind of accumulated as being like something that was like right up my alley, something that I really wanted to get into.
Did you, in looking at your previous work and then this, I think there's like your kind of adaption of kind of setting the tone and kind of style of this book really sells the mood of it. Is that something going in, like, it seems like you're playing with a little like thicker lines, like darker color, like not colors but darker, a lot more shadows, a lot more shapes? Is that something you set out to do with this, kind of setting the tone? Was there something early on you kind of wanted to do, especially with a horror book, kind of building that tension?
So going in I spent probably like over a month just sketching, trying to find a style that I felt would suit the book by experimenting. And I did the same. I drew the main character cat like 100 times in a bunch of different ways, and just to kind of feel. I wanted it. I had read the script and I really knew that like emotion would be a big part of it, and emotive characters, and so that went into it. And I also was kind of like on a binge of reading scary comics. I was trying to find stuff that, because I think horror is a little bit harder to do in a medium without sound. You can't really create like ambience, and like you can't really jump scare anybody. So it's going to be based on a lot of other visual factors. So I was studying, like, I think one of the scariest comics I ever read was The Wolves of St. August. I think that's what it's called. It's a Hellboy book, short story, and I thought that did a really great job. And I'm not at all like Mike Mignola, but I studied stuff like that, and then The Plot came out also, and I was really excited. The Plot is one of my favorite books. They do horror really well in comics, so I actually like studied a lot of Josh Hickson's work on that. I didn't want to like copy him, but I knew I wanted to kind of be in that realm, and so I kind of found a nice little place to settle in, that's basically how I kind of figured it out. And even now I'm still like, oh, I wish I had started it differently, because you can't really just like completely change the style in the middle of the book, and I have ADD, so I'm like, oh, I want to. But I like how it's looking, and I think it works really well to show the emotion of the characters and the stress that they carry, and the tension that's slowly being built throughout the series.
And that's something, I mean, me and Tim have, I think because we both are really into horror comics and also like comedy based or humor comics, like I think those two are two of the hardest things to kind of translate to comics, because a lot of, like you said, you don't have the tension of music, the ability to cut for jump scares and stuff like that. And we discuss a lot, like, the, you know, in comics, the reader has a lot of the control, especially kind of, you know, how fast they page turn, like their ability to kind of wander. Yeah. So like, it's really difficult. And I think you do it extremely well, because I think a lot of the things that work really well is being able to build tension with believable and relatable characters. And obviously, like, a lot of that comes with Daniel, but I think you're like, kind of, you know, emotional expressions and the way you've kind of craft Kat and Sybil and like their relationships feels very genuine when you see the two of them together. They don't feel like stilted or jiffed. But also, like, one of my favorite is like, you, because I think one thing you can do in comics is kind of build tension in the size of the panels and the space. And I like the one page where the funeral home owner or caretaker is coming in. And like when you first see her, she's like in shadow, and she's like framed in the door, and they're like smaller panels, and like she even refers to her as like the creepy old lady, but like it really like builds that, and then everything from that point is like POV from the casket, which is again like is like a really great job of kind of building that visual tension that you can only get, I think, in comics.
And a lot of it, surprisingly, I mean, surprising to me anyway, a lot of elements actually come from Daniel, because of his experience writing, like without pictures, he has to be very visual with his wording. So like a lot of it is designed in his script, and it makes my job a little bit easier. But yeah, I feel like, If there's one thing I bring the most, it's the like the mood and the emotion and expression.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of like really great framing in this. I think I saw it a lot in Prometheus as well. It's like your ability to kind of either put characters in like the two thirds and like but move them from side to side when it's like an emotional moment, or another page of my favorite is the one where we see her at the mirror and it's broken and you see the fist and like the eye, like, so like even in that is like really great, because obviously you don't see her punch it, but you visually get it, and then you get like the payoff with like the eye. I think there's like a lot of great movement from panel to panel in it, which I love the way you like angled the bus on that one. It gives like a great sense of motion, so like a lot of that is really done really well to kind of build almost that like cinematic sense that you kind of want out of a horror based comic.
I appreciate that. I really like how that bus panel came out
for this book, and especially because it's, I mean, it's called The Autumnal, and there's a lot of basis around the leaves in this town. Growing up in the Northeast, I don't remember what episode we referenced it on, Tim.
Yeah, it was recent, though.
Yeah, Tim's originally from out this way, too, so like we are very familiar with leaf peepers. And Like, it's such a goofy term, and I don't even know why. Like, I live in upstate New York, so people drive from the city to come up here to look at leaves. I don't understand it. I mean, it's pretty, I guess, but anyway. So, like, but this town looks believable. Like, it's a really great kind of small New England town. Is this something you had to do research looking into? Especially, I mean, if you're out in Texas, is this something you've kind of looked into, like, to build this, especially when the town is kind of really a character in this story so far?
So I get the leaf peeping thing because I grew up in the desert. Right now I live in Austin and there's trees everywhere, and even just trees everywhere is new to me, but watching like the leaves change and the colors and everything, that's something I don't often get to experience. The town is based on a few different real towns, and I forgot what they are. I found a list of like the prettiest New England towns. That's really all I did, and then I went into Google Maps and into Street View, and I spend like hours like driving quote unquote through these towns to see what they have, you know, like the old like gas lamps, and some of them even have like cobblestone roads and a lot of like red brick buildings and things that I'm not used to seeing. So I wanted to make sure that it was authentic. So I do spend a lot of time like just like exploring these places, and if I could afford it, I would actually like fly out and explore in person, but Google Maps makes it really easy. I love to use the Street View for a reference for a lot of like outdoor background, depending on the area or the situation.
Yeah, there's a lot, like, again, there's a lot of great background work in it, but it is like, I mean, again, growing up out here and a lot of time, I know Tim in Massachusetts and Boston, I lived in Massachusetts as well. Like, it is like any, you could like turn a street and it looks like, I think that one full page where you see like the small town monument, you see the steeple in the background, and you see like the shops with the second floor like wood balconies, like that is like the perfect like New England small town.
Yeah, it definitely, I originally grew up in a very small town in Western Mass, so yeah, the book reminded me of home and kind of made me feel homesick.
Right. And I'll get my job. And you captured the creepiness of all the locals in our small towns. I think one thing that's, again, really interesting in it, and I have to imagine the playing in part, is the kind of looseness of the borders, and it's specifically times they kind of scribble in, like that. I think the one part where the guy raking the leaves sees the leaf fall, and then a little later with the kids, like there are times like it scribbles in. Is there significance to that, or is that just kind of building tension within those moments for you?
So that, I actually, if you look at, if you were to look at my original pages, they don't have any of that. That is actually the colorist, and I Jason Wardy, who is brilliant, and I basically, once I knew he was on board, I was like, okay, he's allowed to do whatever he wants to the art. I don't really leave him notes or anything unless something is like really specific. I let him do his thing because he's going to do it better than me, and he implemented that, and I really like it. But yeah, I believe that's what it does, because that's the way that I see it. It's kind of building tension for the reader, I feel, and between the tension between our main characters and the town where they don't fit in.
It's always kind of amazing, and like you said, Jason is an amazing colorist, one of the best right now, and like that so much, again, because of not only establishing the tone, but again, this kind of town set with like changing color leaves, and there's like really great like almost bleeding watercolor effects. Like, it really sells the book. So like, have you both of you kind of on the same page without real like having the trust of each other is amazing. We were just I think this weekend we were talking about Bill Sienkiewicz, the Demon Bear saga, and like I think it's always lost that like the colorist Glynis Wynn is like really sells Sienkiewicz's art, which is crazy to say because like he's a great, but like to be able to have that kind of trust is that, and then like to have seen your like year inks, especially on like Prometheus, and then like have someone to come in and color it like and be on that like same page for this book to really establish that tone really obviously speaks to kind of what you're able to establish early on, but then when Jason comes in just like kills it.
I can't stress enough how important colorists are, that I've said a lot that a good colorist could make or break a book, or a good or bad colorist could make or break a book. And I had like a list of the colorists that I hoped for when I signed on, and I sent that list to Adrian and Jason Wordy was on it, and a few other really great colorists were on it, and Adrian recommended Jason. He's done a lot of books with Vault and a lot of books in general, and once he was on, I was like, okay, I'm not even gonna pretend like I know what I'm doing, because anything I would have thought of, and I think I'm pretty good with color. I color all my covers, and I like to color, but I know that if I had restricted him in any way, it wouldn't be as good. So I'm letting him really like do his thing on there to the best of his ability, and it's definitely shows. I really love when he all the outdoor shots with the leaves and everything. He really nails that.
Is this book specifically, I think, kind of the way, again, it's colored, but also I think like the actual, like, I guess, quote unquote, like ink colors, line colors. Are you working, is this book digitally for you, or are you working, I know some of the stuff, like I think Prometheus you did, was that pen and ink?
Prometheus was digital, and this is as well. But I do like a little, I often will mix, or occasionally pages will be traditional, depending on if I have time, or if I want to get something across that's harder to do digitally. But for the sake of time, I'm doing it digital so far, and I save the traditional work for my covers for now. But in future issues of this, there will be some traditional interior pages as well.
Is it something we've discussed with some other, I think, Michael Walsh we're talking about, because he's like kind of prolific in covers, and again, like your covers, I think the one you just did for the plot where it's like themed like an old paperback is fantastic. Is there, for people who kind of, you know someone as a coverist, and then there's people who do interiors, and I think a lot of times now we see like the separation of that, is there for you a different mindset going into something on the cover versus kind of your approach to interiors, knowing kind of you have to like sell one image? Is it a different like creative mindset for you?
Yeah, and I wouldn't have thought that there would be, but I always notice that the way I think about covers and even my process is a lot different. So like for interior pages, it's more about the way that you lead the reader's eye throughout the page, and the way you can control their reading speed and things like that. And then obviously then there are the things within that, like the characters' emotions and the acting and the set pieces and stuff. But with covers, the most important thing to me, and I know other people think differently, but for me, I think you need to be able to see it from across the room and know what's going on. And I know a lot of covers, are very detailed and lots of little lines and details and a lot going on, and they look really cool up close and you can look at them. But for me, I prefer just big, strong shapes. A lot of my covers are about that. They're big, strong shapes. They're character portraits or just like a few important elements, a lot of just things that I feel like will make you want to look inside, big, like, simple color palettes. Since I color my covers, I tend to try to stick to like 2 to 3 like main colors that you're seeing. So from far away or up close, you're drawn to the cover. You want to look at it because it's like one big skull or whatever, you know, some one big shape or several like shapes. I'm still like learning and learning from other really, really great cover artists, watching what they do. But that's my main focus when I do covers, is it's big shapes, and with interior pages, it's less about shape for me and more about like the flow of important elements down the page.
Yeah, and I think that, I don't know if, yeah, I've thought of that way, because I mean when you're doing character designs or something like that, like, which again are really about kind of creating the initial image for something, it's all about kind of, you want strong shape, strong, like, silhouettes. And I think you would want that in a cover. That would make most sense, because again, I mean, unless it's like, you know Amazing Spider-Man, where people are going to pick it up, like, you want something that's going to draw the attention, sell it, and then get people inside. Whereas, like, if it's, again, very detailed, like, that's, like, time people are having to spend on the cover when you want them, like, inside. And I think of, like, you know, was it Marcos Martin? Like, those Amazing Spider-Man covers. They're always just, like, a few colors and, like, just, like, Spider-Man against the backdrop. And, like, those are amazing because, like, they're very visually, like, stimulating and, like, selling it that way versus, again, a very detailed thing. And I think it pays off, too, having that mindset when you come to, especially, I think, in a horror comic, like, I won't reveal it, but that, like, final page is so, like, jarring because of, like, the ability to sell one image, which is really important. And, like, interiors, like you said, is very much about controlling pace and kind of pushing, like, eye lines. Like, then being able to kind of revert that to, like, a really striking, strong image is really important as well. And, like, I mean, that final one is amazing.
Yeah, now that I think about it, for, like, splash pages like that, big, important images, I think about them a lot like covers, where it's about shapes. Like, if you were to, like, blur your eye, your vision or something, it's one, like, strong shape, like, not to spoil it, but it's like a strong diagonal shape. And I tend to think of those things in the same way that I would a cover. I want people to see it as one thing, one big thing.
Was another really, this isn't really, almost not a spoiler, but another big, like, full splash page in it is the sidewalk one. Is that, did you have to draw there, or is that?
Yeah, I drew all of
that. How is it kind of dumbing down for, like, trying to establish, like, I have a 7-year-old, this is very close to the stuff I see. He's currently, the two of them are working on Burger Man. Is there... superhero. I haven't told them about that. There's like a Fortnite character that's already a Burger Man, apparently, but I don't want to destroy their dreams. But is that kind of then, like, working down your art for something like this? Is that, I mean, that's obviously, I don't know if that's a silly question, but, like, even, because I know, like, I think it's really tough sometimes for artists to kind of even pull back and, like, you know, you don't go, like, you don't need to go ultra detailed and, like, small figures. Like, it's easier, if you can sell shapes and emotion versus, like, you know, ultra detailed face and a small thing, because it doesn't really matter. Is that something, like, even this, where, like, I think it could come off, like, very a silly page, but again, it's really effective, especially with the bright colors selling very disturbing images.
For the double page spread?
Yeah, the sidewalk chalk.
Oh, for that one. I don't know. It's hard to describe it. I feel like I'm basically like not looking at what I'm drawing, and I try to like really loosen up. If you were to see like my like thumbnails for this book, they almost kind of look like that anyway. I scribble a lot, and I scribble purposefully, like bad proportions and like goofy looking things with a big eye and a small eye and stuff like that. I don't know, it kind of lets me use like a different part of my brain. And so for that, I actually enjoyed trying to think about it the way in a more simplified way that you would see like children drawing. But it's like, it's also the kind of stuff that I'll like just doodle a lot of the time. And so like the most like obviously the most like detailed things on those pages is like the chalk itself and yeah. The like the box of chalk, and then everything else is like little goofy drawings. But it's also important, one thing that when I was working on it, I actually had to change a few things, because you'll get to see all of that imagery later on in the series, but for real. And so it was really important to have that contrast of like happy little cute drawing to like a flashback of that stuff. So like that, I had to like I actually had to go back and like dumb it down a little bit more. So that there would be a big like contrast between what's the reality and what the kids know through like songs and stories.
Right. I think that's what's, that page itself is really amazing, and one like being able to kind of be a really great quick kind of like establishment for like essentially like an info dump, but done like really well and like again creepily, but also like you said, like to then have to be able to kind of draw it simply but sell it that it still like reads like a comic and makes sense. Mm-hmm. Like, alongside again like very detailed chalk and stuff like that with like shadows of trees on the, like it's a very detailed page for something that again, like I think if you like quickly looked at it, you're like, oh, it's like dumbing down this art, but like there's clearly a lot of like thought and like visual storytelling that goes into like, again, something so simple looking on the outside.
Yeah. I sketched it out originally in my thumbnail, and then I sketched out each element that you see there, and then I separately tried to put them in an order that would read properly like a comic without panels, and so that it would still like, you know, it reads left to right and top to bottom, and everything fits, but it still also kind of looks like haphazard, like kids just all got together and drew their favorite parts of the story. And then the shadow of the tree, it was Jason Wordy.
Originally when I had started the show years ago and brought it back with Tim, is like the whole idea is like, again, the amount of effort and work that goes into creating comics for most people to just like, you know, flip through and read or give like really quick criticisms of something that I think, like, again, there's, like, you know, months of effort that go into that. And again, to kind of have that understanding of that work that goes on that page, and then to have Jason come in and draw these, like, color and shade these detailed, like, tree leaves over that, and also color, and, like, it's insane that, like, for, like, one splash page, the amount of, like, thought and effort that goes into making something work.
Yeah, and I have to remind myself, too, that people, that readers will only spend a few seconds looking at some of this stuff. So I try to keep that in mind so I don't spend too much time working on it. Yeah, but then at the same time, I also, for important things, I feel like more detail allows readers to slow down. A lot of times, like, at least for me, when I'm reading a comic, if there's, like, a lot going on in the panel, I'll look at every little thing that's going on, like, even just weird little things, like, if I see, like a building and a fire escape and it's leading to this, like, door or something, and I'm like, my brain is like, whoa, what's in that door? And I look at everything in the page, and I feel like, you can control the pacing with that. So I try to have a balance. I have to remind myself a lot not to draw the background in every single panel, because it's, you don't need it in every single panel. And then, like, loosely draw the background, or, like, more tightly draw the background when needed, stuff like that. But yeah, people will go over it really quick because they don't know how much time goes into it, or they do, but it's just a quick read. It's a comic book, and so yeah, I don't know. I try to balance what I do so I can still, like, I don't entertain people and impress people, but without killing myself.
Right. It's that, and it's like, if you're doing it right, most of the time you won't notice, because, like, again, especially, like, with something like lettering, where, like, no one notices, but you notice when it doesn't work.
Right.
But, like, I'm looking quickly through, like, the shot of Kat and Sybil coming in to the funeral, and, like, the way you have it in the three panels and everything kind of lined vertically down, and, like, have the shot of the casket, the two of them, and then you cut close to Kat with the darker, like, again, kind of blacked out background to really sell, like, the emotion coming to her. Like, that's a quick read through that page, because, again, most of it is just kind of them saying this summer to be able to draw our attention, but, like, it works so effectively because you're, like, narrowing the vision on that to her and kind of selling her, like, dead stare out.
Yeah.
But, like, yeah, like, that, like, understanding of visual storytelling is needed and won't necessarily be, like, but if it wasn't done that way, then it wouldn't work.
Yeah, I agree. And like, thankfully, there's a lot of that in, my favorite thing is to draw, like, close-up expressions of the characters, and this book will have a lot of that. So there's a really good balance between, like, pulling into the characters, but, and then also pulling out and having the environment almost be a character. Like, the town is a character, and the things around are part of it. And I feel like being able to do that is a good way to make the readers feel what the characters are feeling.
For you kind of going into this, I mean, for kind of your first time with a publisher directly in the kind of, like, the direct market, was kind of moving into interiors on, like, a, I guess, monthly title. I don't know how I was trying to find out if you guys were pushed at all for COVID. I don't think so. But was that an easy kind of transition, just working on this book on a monthly basis?
No. I wish. I realized that I'm slower than I thought that I was. And so it's been an educational experience trying to find the things in my process that slow me down, and find things that could speed up my process along the way so that I can make sure that I'm hitting my deadlines. And we were, you know, we started ahead, and while COVID didn't actually push our book, it kind of messed with me a little bit in terms of like messing with my like financial situation and stuff. But it didn't hurt me too much. But yeah, for me, it's been just an experience, because before I wasn't doing anything monthly, and I knew I was fast enough to do something monthly, but when I dove into this book, I wanted to get everything right, and a lot of that like slowed me down, and so I'm learning a lot, which is good. I feel like they're allowing me to. They gave me enough space. I started early enough so that the book's not going to be late, but I'm learning a lot and figuring things out as I go.
Do you guys... I had a question about your working with Daniel Krauss. He co-wrote the novelization of The Shape of Water. Mm-hmm. And how much pressure did he put on you to include a giant fish monster in this book?
Not he didn't, thankfully. Though I would have probably enjoyed it nonetheless.
Does he casually bring it up in emails? You know, that time I was working with... Well, he's done like two things with Del Toro, I think, right? He did Trollhunters.
Yeah, he also did Trollhunters.
Yeah. No, he doesn't. I want to casually bring it up because I'm such a huge Guillermo Del Toro fan, but I also don't want to like come across like a big nerd. So
I don't. It's always the case too. It's always the people you want to like bring it up, never do, and the people you don't want to hear things about. You're like, I don't want to hear that.
Yeah. Like, I don't know, maybe it'd be cool if somehow Guillermo del Toro read our book and enjoyed it. But either way, it's really cool that he got to work with him. I really love those books, and I love I love The Shape of Water, the movie, as well as I haven't seen Trollhunters, but I really like The Shape of Water. I really like the Guillermo del Toro's use of practical effects and stuff like that. So I'm always thinking about it when I'm talking to Daniel, but I never bring it up.
Well, once he listens to this, he'll know to bring it up.
Yeah.
Or he just casually in like emails like, yeah, I'll get to that. I was busy watching The Shape of Water. I didn't, you know, and I'm not sure you're familiar with that film, but I do think, I guess referencing del Toro in like, you know, obviously famous for kind of the creature designs and the things he's working with, but specifically maybe like Pan's Labyrinth or kind of Hellboy 2, where we got the like, I can't think of the name. It was like an eternal, it was like that big, the plant monster Hellboy like kills. So like in this book, again, not spoiling anything, and again, Chris was nice enough to offer us the second issue to read, and I've held off because, like one, I don't want to even reference a spoiler, but also, like, I'm really excited to read it. But kind of the things you're alluding to in the sense of horror in this seem like a very specific kind of style. Is that something, do you kind of have a reference point for where you're going with the look of that, and you even referenced the plot, which again has like amazing visuals in it. Is there, as the series progresses, are you going to be able to kind of skew in the more like horrific imagery for you?
Yeah. Each issue gets, so it starts off kind of a pretty slow burn, and the first couple issues are slow, but it definitely, it picks up pace, like it picks up the pace exponentially. And I read the whole script in one sitting for the whole series, and I did a lot of design work, and so you're gonna see like moving forward, you're gonna see it's gonna get like gross and scary and that'll be more of like where I get to like really play around with texture and like not spoiling anything, but it's gonna get scarier.
Yeah, I love, again, I feel bad, but again, if you're listening to this, it's out. If you have to, pause it, go read it. Hopefully you've read it. Again, it's an amazing first issue. Like, I love, like, the slow burn horror and kind of the build up, and that, like, final image that kind of really sets the tone going forward is amazing, and it reminds me of, like, Hannibal, which I think visually is really amazing, kind of what they did, and then even like that first season of like True Detective. I love that, like this very like he's kind of almost grounded style of horror and very earthy, stuff like that. Like, I'm very excited to see kind of what you're able to work with going forward.
Yeah, the slow burns are my favorite, and I really love horror that I love stuff where the monster or whatever, the creature, the monster, the bad guy is present, you know, the entire time, and you don't really realize it. My favorite movie of all time is Alien. And I really love how that is kind of a slow burn, and there are like, you know, jump scares and stuff, but there's scenes where the xenomorph is just there in the background of the shot, and like but you have to really like look to see it. You don't always catch it in your first viewing, and so this is our book is like that, where the most of the horror takes place in the tension that's built between the characters in the town. But later on, you're gonna see it.
Yeah, I made the mistake of, I realize it now, naming our newest son. We named him Ripley, because again, Alien is like for me one of the quintessential horrors, and then we're trying to name something after like a strong female character, and I talked my wife into Ripley because it works kind of in a unisex way. Mm-hmm. But then I was like, well, I don't know, I can't, like, because it's come up a couple times with our other kid where like they'll have like a school project, like, why is your kid named this? And I'll have to be like, oh, he's named Winter after the Winter Soldier because Ed Brubaker's and like I'm like, oh fuck, I'm gonna ruin this kid's life. And now I have another kid where I'm like, I can't show you why you're named this way because, like, I don't know what's an appropriate age for Alien, but just trust me, it's great. Yeah, I was like, even the Haunting of Hill House, like, that was one of my favorite things. Is again, oh, yeah. throughout that whole thing, like, I mean, there's obviously present jump scares, but like the beauty of that show is like there throughout the show, the horror is kind of always there, the monster's always there, ever present, yeah. And like you can kind of go back into it. And even again, that's like the beauty of comics, even if it's not a horror comic, but like I love the second read through, like even in this there's a lot of detail you guys put in, like because the scene of her punching the mirror is essentially a flashback when she's back in the office and on the bus, you can actually see like that right hand like bandaged up, which is like mm-hmm. a really great like detail in that. So it's like a lot of small things that kind of work to like sell a larger like story and narrative.
Yeah, and speaking of Hill House, that was a big influence on me for this like studying that. I love like studying like film and like really well done TV for I don't know. My influences for comics are more movies than actual comics, and so that's one thing that I definitely was a big influence on me for this, the visual storytelling that they use in Hill House.
I think two of my final questions. I mean, you kind of reference it, but like, is Vault has been kind of like there's either like kind of set narratives, like minis, like they tell one story. or that like the plot has kind of been able, one that's been extended. Do you guys have, you guys have essentially a set story for this? Is there like idea it could continue, or do you guys have like a single story you want to tell with this for right now?
For right now, it's one single story and 8 issues, but I'm not sure about the future as of right now.
8 issues, that's a good, that's a good chunk. And
yeah, I'm excited about that.
Yeah, that will be a nice hardcover when Vault starts doing.
Yeah, that's my hope. I love all their books. I feel like I don't keep long boxes anymore. So having like a bookshelf and pretty books to sit on it is always my favorite thing. So I'd love some Vault hardcovers.
Yeah, I have done the same, as slowly got rid of all my floppies, and you know, for the weeklies I read digitals, and again, me and Tim are in Comics Press, so we only get paid in review copies from the publishers. So I've done that. So I've taken all that and put it into like, you know, hardcovers and like on the buses and artist edition stuff like that. Because again, like that's like a whole nother like level of comics being in a medium where like the planning that goes into putting together like a library edition of something. But
yeah,
I saw you, I think it was today, yeah, tweet that. I was like, he's one of us.
I love that stuff. I love the trade paperbacks too. I have a ton. But I just, every time I see like a Hellboy library edition, I think that's the coolest thing. And to see comics like immortalized in something that will last a lot longer, that, I just think that's the coolest. So I'd love to see more of that. And I think Vault has some of the best looking books in all of comics right now. So just having just a hardcover set of all their books would be so cool.
I don't know the setup, because I just discovered it like I think last year, but there's like a store called like Ollie's. It's like a weird store. I don't know if you guys have them out that way.
No, I haven't heard of it.
Yeah, it's like a warehouse store, like where they like do buyouts and stuff. So like within the last year they started buying out like comics from, I don't know if it's from Diamond or what it is, but they've been getting like lots of buyouts of like DC and Marvel. So they have like crazy like hardcovers and stuff like that for like really cheap. So like they just apparently got like a new supply, and so like I went this past weekend and they had like the Avengers Vibranium thing. It's like this thing weighs more than like my kids combined. I'm like lugging around. It's like this huge thing. It's over 12, it's huge. I don't know where to put it. It's like as big as like an artist edition, but it's like 700 pages. And again, I own most of that, but I was like, oh, it's cool. I'll put it on the shelf. I'll never read it, or I can take it out and like show my kids and not let them touch it, because I don't want them to ruin anything. But it's like, but it's like that itself is like such a presentation. I think, and it's like a $200 thing. It was only like $30, but the idea of like, again, of that, the appreciation that goes into the medium and doing that. Yeah, I think Vault, especially their covers, like if you throw one of those on like a cover, it would be fantastic.
Yeah. Oh, and I was also like, I thought it'd be a cool idea to have all of like Vault's covers, like variant covers, everything put into like a, like just an art book.
Mm-hmm.
I think publishers have done that. I have like a Top Cow one, and it's just cover art throughout the whole thing. From like old stuff, and speaking of covers, I think that'd be awesome. Just a big art book full of covers.
Is that, I mean, I think Vault is one that has been, especially kind of as the everything has happened with COVID and the pandemic and the direct market with DC and Marvel, I think people have seen like Vault, who's been killing it and kind of continued to, and me and Tim have done a lot with like creators on Scout Comics recently. I think they've been doing a lot. Like Grit is like
a
fantastic book. Is working with, like, you referenced kind of wanting to work with vaults. Is that something, as a creator, kind of coming up, like, the idea of those being, I guess, like, on the map as like, kind of publishers that are doing the type of things you like as a creator?
Yeah, I when I first, like, started actually reading comics, I didn't grow up reading comics. I didn't actually, like, start reading comics until I was 18. And I quickly, like, really fell in love with Vertigo stuff. Mm. And I feel like Vault is, like, its own version of that, where it's, like, you're finally getting, like, I feel like comics are being pushed to their max, and they're not sticking to, like, a house style or just following the same tropes or same things that comics have followed for a long time. Vault and, like, even, like, now Scout, companies like that are starting to, TKO is another one, mm-hmm. they're starting to push the medium, like, as hard as they can to make it, to get the best out of it. And so for me, discovering Vault, like, several years ago, it was a goal for me to do a book with them, like as if, like, it was a goal for someone to draw Spider-Man, you know, back in the day, or maybe even now. I always wanted to do a book with Vault since, for the last few years at the very least. And so being able to do that is really cool. It's definitely a big goal for me.
So if you're coming into reading comics around 18, what was your kind of in for being an artist? What did you start around that time for your that, or is it something, were you coming in, like, painting or doing art and then kind of found comics?
I was always drawing, and I've been drawing forever, and I've always felt like I was decent at it, decent enough at least, in, like, not quit or whatever. It was really just, like, I don't know, ego, I guess, because nobody when they're a little kid is that good at drawing. But I something in me was like, no, I'm not gonna stop. And so I drew all the time, and I've always also loved telling stories. So I thought maybe I would grow up to be a writer or a filmmaker or something like that. I didn't really even consider comics. It's just, I drew a lot, and I told stories a lot, and I wrote stories a lot. And I attempted animation for a while when I was younger, and I actually made a lot of short films and little movies when I was younger. And it wasn't until, like I saw a comic, and I knew they existed, but I just, for some reason, it didn't even, like, occur to me to do that. But I saw a comic when I was maybe 12 years old or so, and I don't really consider that's when I started reading comics, because I read, like, one comic. I didn't ever go to a comic shop. I didn't buy anything else. I just read one comic that my stepdad at the time had, and I was, like, blown away by it. So I just started telling my stories as little comics, and I drew little comics from age, like, 12, 13, all the way up until I was 18. I drew a lot of little comics in, like, sketchbooks and stuff. And when I was young, I also, like, printed them and sold them to my friends for, like, a quarter or whatever. So, they were just dumb little, like, silly comics. And I started, like, trying to tell, like, more, like, bigger epic stories, but my art wasn't good enough. And when I went to college, I thought, okay, I should get better at art so I can actually do comics. And my college happened to be, it was just a regular university, a regular state university, they happened to be offering one of the English lit classes was covering comics specifically, and it counted as, like, my basics. And I was like, oh, I don't have to read a bunch of old novels, and I can get my English literature taken care of. And that's when I actually saw comics for real and what their potential could be. And that class exposed me to a lot of comics. And so from there, I like started making more comics, and I started getting like real little freelance jobs and started showing my portfolio to editors and stuff from that point. But I've always drawn, and I've always kind of made little comics since as long as I can remember.
Kind of building off that, and I've seen you reference it like occasionally on Twitter, and this now kind of being, I think, a, you know, a time, it's never, I don't say never been easier, but it's, I think, more, is there something, or is there a goal for you to kind of either do writing or do your kind of own, both writing and art? Is that something you're building towards or been working on or would like to do?
Yeah, it is something I'd like to do, but because I do this full time, it's like now I do this full time, it's harder to, I have a lot of potential freelance work as an artist with a writer, and I would need at least a little gap of my own time to prove that I can also write. But it is a goal. It's harder, and I'm hoping to have the opportunity to pitch my own thing when I'm done with this book, at least for the future or something. But I do have several stories, and a lot of it is written down, and I have character designs and pages even, and I need time to put it together to show that I can do it, so someone will give me money to do it, because I can't do it for free at this moment. I can't afford, I don't have the time or the money, and so I need a little bit of both. So I'm hoping to have a little bit of gap of free time to at least put together a pitch. But yeah, that's a goal, and I'm not in a hurry either. I know I have time. I just but it's definitely a goal to write and draw my own stories in the future. But I do love working with writers. That I love the collaborative nature of comics, and I'll never not do that.
And I mean, obviously, your work prior, but this issue, like showcasing visually, and again, hearing you talk about kind of the approach early on or growing up of kind of wanting to be a filmmaker, like it is a very, I think your eye is very cinematic in your, especially your panel approaches and layouts to that, like is a very cinematic approach to kind of understanding that, again, as kind of like a camera view of that. Before Tim's final question, this is occasionally one thing we'll try and bring up when we remember that is a quote unquote bit, is I doing a lot of interviews for like sites. I like to squeeze in as many like puns as possible, and I love like review coverage, like reviewers love to put like puns and clever things in there. I've seen a few with the autumnal, like I've seen people like the perfect like autumn book, or like as the seasons change. I think I've seen that a couple times. For you, is there something you would like reviewers to use, or is there a pun you've seen or have thought of for your book yet?
I'm not sure. I joke a lot with my girlfriend when we take walks, that I always say, like, she's in the leaves, she's gonna get you. And because like I read the whole script to her, and I've showed her the art, and she's also she helps me take like reference photos. She's kind of like the basis of Cat. A lot of Cat is based on her, not completely, but a lot of it is. So I use her for reference for Cat. And so that's just something that I that I joke with her about. I say she's in the leaves and she's going to get you.
That is a good one. I will... So, if anyone's listening, you can't... You, no, I don't care. You can use it. Because I am like... Again, I will go out of my way to make it a long one as the title. And almost 80% of the time, my editor changes it. Like, and doesn't ask me because he just... At this point, he'll just change it because he hates them. But so I got for the autumnal... Set your peepers on the autumnal and don't leaf this title on the shelf.
Oh, my God.
That's a pretty good one. Which it's so bad it will lead perfectly into Tim's final question.
All right, so Chris, gun to your head, if you were forced to write one episode of The Big Bang Theory, what would happen?
They would break the fourth wall, and they would all quit because they would realize that this is just not good. And but the cameras would still be filming, and they would all like walk off the like the little stage, and the audience would still be there, and they would be laughing and stuff. But they would like, they would quit the show because it's just, I don't like it.
Yeah, that would be, oh my God, is there? I'm pretty sure there's an episode of, is it The Fresh Prince? I think there's one where something like that happens with the audience. That would be perfect.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of sitcoms actually did that, where they were like the main character is like still themselves, but they all of a sudden realize they're on a show and they're so confused.
At some point when I down the road, I don't know, what are we on? I should know. Episode, whatever. Like. Whatever we're on of you asking that final question, it kickstarted like a comic of all the, like, everyone has come in with, that's one of the better ones I've enjoyed. People,
yeah,
have coming in. It's gonna bug me now. I know there's a Fresh Prince where, I know, maybe it's, I'm thinking of the one where Carlton runs around and is dragging himself on the floor. I don't think that's that one, but. Again, if you're listening to this, it is out. It is one of the best first issues I've read this year or in comics. It's fantastic. I'm so excited to literally get off and go read the second one. For anyone who wants to find your work or find you and tell you how much they enjoyed this, how can they do that?
My Twitter is the best way. I check that probably more often than I check my email. So it's just at Chris Sheehan Art, and there's one E in my last name. A lot of people put two E's. So yeah, it's just at Chris Sheehan Art.
Yeah, Tim, what are you doing? Especially now that you're, apparently your site is attached to your Twitter. How can people find out about the new season of Riverdale?
I write over at Comics Pit, and you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Tim Madera. Remember hooking up my personal Twitter to tweet out every article that we write, but it's going strong.
Yeah, that's the way to do it. Yeah, and we're pages, underscore panels, whatever. If you've listened to the show, you probably know how to find us. Again, the more important thing is to go out and pick up this book if for some reason you haven't, or continue, and also spam the Vault Twitter account for hardcovers. They did respond with a shrug to me earlier today, so I'm gonna bug them continually. Just the oversized, we need to get oversized hardcovers for all Chris's art and Jason's colors. But again, it is a phenomenal first issue. I can't stress that enough. So thank you so much for joining us. Obviously, this is the night before, but I'm excited for everyone to kind of pick this up tomorrow and can't wait for more.
Yeah, I appreciate you having me on. Thank you so much.
No problem.
Yeah, thank you. This is fun.
And that's this issue of Pages and Panels. And next episode, Tim, we will definitely, we will get back to George Lopez at some point, I promise.